with 24-6124, Lamley, and I know I'm going to pronounce the defendant's name incorrectly, but AIDS, or, but counsel for appellant, if you would make your appearance and proceed, please.
I may please the court. My name is Craig Riffle for the appellant. We're here today because the court dismissed this case on a 12B6 motion. And we all know what Twombly says, so I'm not going to spend my time on it. But I think what was interesting in Twombly, the Supreme Court made the statement of stating a well-pled complaint may proceed even if it strikes a savvy judge that actual proof of the facts is improbable and recovery is very remote and likely. The Supreme Court followed later in Skinner, talking about the fact that in reviewing a 12B6 motion, the court does not assess a complaint, the complaint's legal feasibility, or weigh the evidence that will be offered at trial. That's exactly what the district court did in this case. The district court tried this case in the motion to dismiss. This is a 1983 action. In West v. Adkins, the Supreme Court stated that to state a claim under 1983, the plaintiff must do two things. Allege a violation of a right secured by federal law and show that the alleged deprivation was conducted under a person acting under color of law. The plaintiff has, the appellant has done both of those. Now we are proceeding under 42 U.S. 1396A8. It's referred to as the reasonable promptness standard in Medicaid. What it talks about, it says people wishing to apply for Medicaid are free to do so, and the state must allow them to do so and furnish benefits with reasonable promptness. There are two implementing regulations that are at issue here. The first requires that those applications be reviewed and processed within 45 days. That clearly didn't happen here. In Ms. Lamley's case, at the time of filing the complaint, it was 181 days since she had filed her application. In Ms. Houston's case, it was 117 days. The second implementing regulation that's at issue here is the state, as the district court found, the state is not free to just ask anything it wants to in those Medicaid applications. There are limits. The implementing regulation prohibits the agency from requiring information which is not necessary to making the eligibility determination. So what's really going on here? What's this case about?
The case is about initially is whether you have a right to be heard. I mean, the elephant in the room is jurisdiction. And so I need to have you explain to me, although it is not precedential, why the reasoning of PECA does not apply here and does not say that we don't have jurisdiction. And as I see it, just to cut to the chase of what my concern is, as I read your brief, you say that that PECA is distinguishable because appellants are not asking for an injunction ordering their certification of Medicaid eligibility and the payment of Medicaid benefits, but rather are questioning the process that the appellees used and its lack of conformity with federal law. But the reality is I look at paragraphs A and B of the second amended complaint, and they ask for exactly those things that you say you're not asking for. I mean, A and B talk about an injunction. They talk about an injunction that would allow you to get benefits. Why doesn't PECA map nicely onto this case?
Okay. I tried PECA, and when this case was filed, Ms. Lamley and Ms. Houston were alive. That's why those paragraphs are in the complaint. They died during the pendency of the complaint, or during the pendency of the action. Now, what PECA stands for is we go back to the 11th Amendment immunity, which says an individual cannot sue the state. However, we have the Ex parte Young decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that carved out an exception to that. That exception is that an individual can proceed against the state if they're seeking prospective injunctive relief.
Yeah, and Ex parte Young will get you past the 11th Amendment, but how does that get you past mootness?
Well, on the PECA decision, what happens is Ms. Lamley and Ms. Houston asked for three relief. They didn't just ask for their Medicaid applications to be certified. They asked for three different things. They asked, number one, that their applications be processed timely. They asked, number two, the second claim for relief is that the correct criteria be applied in processing those applications. And then number three, they asked for certification of their Medicaid benefits. Now, because of their death, the third claim goes away, but the other two do not.
Okay, let's say we agree with you. I don't mean to point at you. I have a bad habit of doing that.
I get it all the time.
Sorry. If we grant a prospective injunctive relief and say Ms. Lamley and Ms. Houston were entitled to a timely processing, a decision within 45 days, and Ms. Eads should not have been asking these irrelevant questions, and we grant relief, how does that help you?
Okay.
The Medicaid benefits, I mean, I assume that they want, a prompt decision, and they want relevant questions in order to facilitate something that will benefit them other than just better process. They can't get Medicaid benefits to pay for a nursing home. They're not in a nursing home. They're deceased.
Well, under 1396A34, it does allow for the retroactive payment of benefits, even to an estate.
Yeah, and that's why I was asking about prospective injunctive relief.
Okay, so what we are asking for, the appellants are the estates, and what the estates are asking for is that the applications be processed timely under the correct criteria. The estates believe that if that happens, that there will be an approval for benefits. The estate's not asking the court to order that the state certify and require the state to pay those benefits. That's what PECA's about. That's what PECA says. PECA was all about, the only claim in PECA was a claim for certification for the retroactive payment of benefits.
So if we grant prospective injunctive relief, you get better process. And so ideally you get retroactive benefits, but that is clearly barred by the 11th Amendment. Ex parte Young involves an action against an individual officer in his or her official capacity.
What's barred?
For prospective injunctive relief. I don't know how Ex parte Young would get you past the bar under the 11th Amendment for retroactive monetary relief. That seems clearly barred under the 11th Amendment.
Because the court's not ordering it.
Because what?
The court is not ordering it.
I see.
The court cannot order that. And we have to believe if the court requires the state to process those applications correctly, then the state's going to do what they should do. And then they would find eligibility. We don't know that. This case is not about...
Okay, so let's say they find eligibility. How can you ultimately get benefits in light of this dual bar between the 11th Amendment on retroactive monetary relief and the mootness of prospective injunctive relief?
Well, the 11th Amendment bars and the court from acting to do that.
Yeah.
It doesn't bar the state from
doing that. Oh, I see. Okay.
We believe in good faith that the state will do what they're supposed to if they're asking the right questions. But the bar of the 11th Amendment bars the court from making that order. That's what PECA was about. Now, as far as mootness, it is not moot. There is still, if the case is processed correctly and the benefits are awarded, the estates are entitled to receive those benefits. So there's still an amount of controversy in this case that's still alive.
What PECA addressed, though, was the notion of a continual injury. And there is no injury to an individual for what is at stake here, which is ultimately, you're talking about process, but it's process with the end game, which you acknowledge, of getting benefits. And so there is not an individual that is suffering an ongoing injury of federal law.
Because PECA was awarding benefits in this particular case. The ongoing injury is the estate, those applications that are sitting there that are not being processed timely or under correct criteria is affecting the estates of those individuals. The appellants in this case are the estates of the individuals. So if the court orders that those applications be processed correctly, we believe the state will do that, award those benefits, which then flow to the estate.
I guess what I'm struggling with, as I see what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, which is essentially this case is not PECA because it's one distance removed from PECA. PECA was dealing with the actual award of benefits. In this case, you're talking about process. You didn't get the process you think you're due. In your view, if you were to receive relief as it relates to process, you would ultimately, the state would do the right thing and ultimately give you benefits.
That is correct, Your
Honor. Okay. Well, as it relates to that, the question still becomes, in order to have a finding of lack that process was incorrect or wrong, you have to have a violation of federal law an ongoing violation of federal law as it relates to somebody. I mean, why there has to be, you know, you say there's a process violation, but who is in a position to claim injury by virtue of process? If you say the estate, I don't see how PECA would call for that.
Well, it is the estates, but again, PECA is limited to the 13th, 11th Amendment bars the court from ordering that. It doesn't bar the state from granting that.
So no, I know, I get that, but by at least by your own admission, it's as I understand it, you're acknowledging that this is one step along the road to get benefits, right?
That is correct.
Okay, and on this particular step, though, you have to have some sort of prospective relief provided to you. Is that not true?
That is correct.
Okay, and on that prospective relief, the underpinning of that has to be an ongoing violation of federal law, and that ongoing violation of federal law has to inflict a continual injury on somebody, right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, then the somebody in this instance, as you understand it, I think, as and you correct me, it would be the estates, right?
Correct.
Okay. If PECA doesn't map onto this, then give me your best case that tells me why the estate suffer an injury in this situation. Because the reality is the statute, it speaks in terms of individuals.
Okay. So the estate is out the money that should have been paid under the Medicaid benefits. That's the injury. And the federal law that's at issue is 1396AA8, which requires that benefits for all eligible individuals be provided timely. Now, the implementing regulation that's at issue is in 42 CFR chapter, it's 435.9.07E1. And the district court even recognized that implementing regulation, and the district court even recognized that the state doesn't have an absolute right to go ask anything they want to in processing the applications. So if the prospective relief is granted as to processing the applications correctly, it's our belief the state will do that, award the benefits which will go to the estate. There's the ongoing claim.
What's the authority, which is what I asked you, that would support this matter? Because if you're claiming PECA is inapposite and distinguishable, then there must be something that you rely on that says that the estate actually in this process can be suffering a continual injury by virtue of violation of federal law.
Okay, that's Title 42 U.S.C. 1396 AA 34, which allows a state to recover Medicaid benefits for a deceased individual. It specifically says that in that paragraph.
Well, that they would have been entitled to, the benefits would have been awarded. The estate can get the benefits that have been awarded. Here, no benefits have been awarded.
The estate can even file an application after the person's deceased.
To get benefits, right?
Yes. Well,
there have been no benefits awarded. That's the problem.
Well, but they can file an application after the person's deceased to recover benefits under that paragraph.
That should have been granted.
That should have been granted.
All right.
So we're talking about the timeline where benefits would have been granted to these three deceased people who were alive when they applied for the benefits.
Yes.
And they should have been granted the benefits, and they would have been given money, and the state is entitled to the money that they would have gotten but didn't get, right?
Yes. And one thing that I think it's important to note, the 11th Amendment immunity doesn't apply to Ms. Eads. Right. She's also a defendant. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may.
I'm going to give you another minute because I want to deal with this right now. As it relates to Ms. Eads, in your reply brief, you say the issue of Ms. Eads' personal liability was never ruled on by the district court. Therefore, it was improper for appellants to raise this issue on appeal. And then you go on to cite cases like Pacific Frontier where they did a remand. Well, you didn't ask for a remand in the reply brief. In your opening brief, you didn't make a fulsome argument regarding why you're entitled to relief as it relates to Ms. Eads. So I don't understand why Ms. Eads, you haven't waived that.
Waived the claim against Ms. Eads?
Absolutely. Because the court entered judgment whether it spoke about misdeeds or not, it entered a full judgment in favor of the defendants. And so if you were going to challenge something about what the court did, even the court's failure to speak about misdeeds, now was the time. And the fact that you say it's not the proper time, it is exactly the proper time. So you haven't done that. And so I don't understand why Ms. Eads, any claim against her is not waived.
Well, it wasn't ruled upon, but we addressed everything that the district court ruled upon. I was referring to the 11th Amendment. The 11th Amendment doesn't apply to an individual.
My point was that whether the district court ruled upon it or not, it expressly did not say anything about Ms. Eads. It entered judgment. And when you address that in your reply brief, you cited cases in which we had ordered a remand. What I'm saying is you did not ask for a remand in the reply brief. So what ground is it for us to do anything?
But
Please, go ahead.
Your Honor, when judgment was entered, we contested the judgment that was entered. So if the judgment dealt with Ms. Eads' liability, we objected to that order being entered that would dismiss that liability.
You didn't make an argument in the opening brief, did you, or did I miss it Ms. Eads' liability?
We made an argument to everything that the court addressed.
All right.
And so if those rulings dismissed her liability, we contested those.
Okay. As I said, I'll give you an additional minute unless there are any questions from my colleagues.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Card. I'm here on behalf of Deborah Shropshire in her official capacity and Susan Eads in her individual capacity. Your Honor, I'd like to begin with the mootness argument. The PECA court was directly on point. It alleged it's been decades of constitutional law that it's constitutionally moot if the plaintiff is requesting prospective relief in an injunction and the prospective relief is no longer viable. It's now impossible because the individual is dead.
PECA is not directly on point. I mean, we have a footnote 4 which says that we will not ruminate or opine on whether the outcome would have been different in Ms. PECA's estate was the plaintiff appellant. Well, we have a state here, so you have to explain to me why we should nevertheless apply PECA.
Because the individual to whom the Medicaid regulations and statutes are applicable is no longer living. So she can no longer be given, she no longer has to go to a nursing home because she's not alive anymore. Therefore, there's no benefits to pay.
What about retroactive benefits that they should have been granted?
I would like to address that because I don't believe that was addressed in the opening brief. And I would like, if the court is going to consider that statute, I believe you said 1396 AA, I would like a chance for the parties to brief that specific issue if the court is so inclined about retroactive benefits and how they interact with mootness and whatnot, because that wasn't fully briefed. I don't believe it was brought up in the opening brief. I certainly didn't respond to it.
And to be clear, I thought I heard opposing counsel say that the estate had a legal authorization to seek benefits that were essentially denied through timeliness or denied through some sort of improper process. There was a provision that would allow them to do that. Do you disagree with that?
A provision in the
statute.
I don't know the answer to that because it wasn't briefed, Your Honor.
That is not a position they've taken before now, is what you're saying.
That is correct.
Okay.
But substantively, Your Honor, if I may move on, the elements of an informal loan for it to be bona fide are a few things. One, there has to be a loan between individuals who are not in the business of lending or lending money or providing credit, and the repayment plan must be feasible, meaning the borrower has to be able to pay it back. And DHS has to know, can that person pay it back? In these two instances, for instance, the borrower in Ms. Houston's case had to pay about $90,000 a year back. In the Lamley case, it was about $40,000 a year back. That's a pretty substantial amount for any individual to pay back per year for a loan. Thus, it would make sense then for DHS and its employees to inquire, can this borrower, in fact, make these payments? As the court is aware, a separate DHS non-party employee asked five questions. The plaintiffs refused to answer them. Ms. Eads then steps in and provides legal citations, including the Rose case, including the statutes, including the regulations, about why they are asking these specific questions. For instance, were they in the business of lending money? That's the first element of whether it's an informal loan or not. Whether collateral was given. Well, if collateral is given, the lender can sell it and get their money back, and perhaps the borrower is more likely to pay them back. They've got a collateral on the line. Every one of these have to do exactly with whether the borrower can pay back this $90,000 a year or $40,000 a year. And the plaintiffs acknowledged explicitly that they didn't provide any information that would let DHS know whether it was feasible for the borrowers to pay it back. And I know that because it's in the emails. It said the only possible element not answered by the note itself is the feasibility of repayment plan. That's their words. Now, that is followed up by threats of lawsuit, not anything but threats of lawsuit. There's no, but if you look at this document, or let me help you, or we would like to get approved for benefits, so let me tell you why it's feasible for these repayments to be done. None of that happened.
What do we do with Ms. Eads in this case? I'm struggling to figure out, is she in this case? What is the implication of the posture of the briefing in this case as it relates to Ms. Eads?
I briefed it under the impression that she was still in the case and they were still trying to go after her for money damages under 1983. That's how I briefed it and understood it, though I think I even put in my brief that the jurisdictional statement was confusing to me because part of it, they end at, we want injunctive relief. And then toward the end they said, well, Ms. Eads, 11th Amendment doesn't apply to Ms. Eads. So it was confusing to me, so what I did is I just did the shotgun approach and briefed it as if Ms. Eads was still in the case. That said,
go ahead, please.
Well, not at the district court level and not at this level has the plaintiffs provided one single case that would deny Ms. Eads' right to absolute immunity or qualified immunity for that matter.
What do we do with the fact that the district court did not address Ms. Eads' liability? What is the implication of that? And I thought it was your contention that they had abandoned any claim against Ms. Eads. I thought there was some language in the reply brief to that effect.
I believe what was written was, it's not clear if they abandoned it, but assuming they didn't, here you go. Here's our argument against it, because okay. I wanted to make sure it was caught.
Okay. Well, what do we do with the fact that the district court did not address Ms. Eads? Is that a matter of legal significance?
Not for her liability, because she raised absolute immunity, she raised qualified immunity, and the district court, whether she said her name or not, the district court went through the analysis and what Ms. Eads is alleged to have done and said there was no right violated by DHS. And this was through Ms. Eads' alleged conduct. Therefore, there was no right that Ms. Eads violated. And as the Supreme Court told us in Pearson versus Callahan, the district court doesn't have to get to, it can do either prong of the qualified immunity analysis in either way it sees fit. A lot of times they'll go straight to whether it was clearly established law. This time the district court went to, was there a right actually violated? And she definitively determined there was not a right actually violated.
They're seeking, as I understand it, under 1983, individual liability as it relates to Ms. Eads, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
For asking questions over email.
All right.
The only for absolute immunity, they cite Mitchell versus Forsyth, which only stood for the proposition that just because you're an attorney general of the United States doesn't mean you're absolutely immune. What the court should look at is the function of the government attorney and what he or she is doing at the time of the alleged wrongdoing. It's clear what Ms. Eads was doing. She is an attorney for DHS. DHS is her only client. DHS was getting pushback from a lawyer for not answering feasibility questions, which are really pretty straightforward and you would think would be readily available just to hand it over. They didn't do that. So Mrs. Eads stepped in and she asked the questions and cited authority.
They take the position that in their long requests for Medicaid, the answers are in there.
I'm sorry?
They take the position that in their long, multiple page application for Medicaid, the answers to these questions are in there. If you check that.
They're not. That's just not true. Okay. There's nothing in there about feasibility. There's nothing in there about a lot of it's transferring mineral rights and mineral deeds and bank statements, but it has nothing to do with whether the borrower can actually repay this loan.
Even if it's not true, since we're here on a 12B6, can we affirm the dismissal just based on saying, well, the plaintiff's allegations are just not true? Isn't that contrary to our standard?
They didn't allege that they met feasibility in the complaint. So the answer is no, because that's not how it was pled. They said, we violated the 45-day rule, and that they believe they have a right to Medicaid. But they never said, here is the documentation that we provided that made it possible for Jason Lamley to pay back this $90,000 loan. That was never in the complaint. It wasn't in the documents. And it was never provided to us. To this day, it was not provided to us.
Let me circle back to where you began regarding PECA. Let's assume for the moment that there's enough there that we find PECA persuasive, and that at least it would seem to me that that deals with the prospective claims. What does that do with Ms. E, since we're talking about her being in this case, what does that do with the claims against her, which are not seeking prospective relief? In other words, the logic of PECA was you're seeking prospective claims, you have to have an ongoing injury, you have dead folks, and you can't have an ongoing injury, therefore we have no jurisdiction. But what does that do with the claims against Ms. Eads, where they're not seeking prospective relief, they're seeking damages? What happens then? Let's assume that scenario. What would happen to those claims?
I think PECA is an opposite to Ms. Eads.
Okay.
So PECA is only going to apply to DHS or Shropshire in her official capacity.
So we would still have to deal with, on the merits, whether their claim has any, whether their challenge, appellate challenge, has any viability as it relates to Ms. Eads.
That's correct.
Okay.
And back to the functionality, it was clear what Ms. Eads was doing. She was investigating a case on behalf of the government agency in preparation for administrative hearings, which are allowed if they're denied Medicaid, federal lawsuits, which clearly happened if Medicaid benefits are denied. This is the basis for the functionality test, which is absolute immunity, case after case. But even if she weren't absolutely immune, it's clear she has qualified immunity. What is the claim here? That a lawyer for a government agency wrote an email and asked questions related to a Medicaid application. That's it. That is the extent of Ms. Eads' wrongdoing, according to plaintiff, is wrote an email and asked questions. They never alleged that she actually denied them Medicaid benefits, nor could they, because she doesn't have the power to do that. She's their lawyer. And by the way, how is she supposed to defend the case if it goes forward? Is she to be asked, how did you advise your client on these Medicaid applications? Surely not. DHS has a right to attorney-client privilege. And if we go to qualified immunity, as I said, the district court determined that there was no right violated, so she didn't need to go to whether it was clearly established. In the district court, in this court, I've yet to see a case from the plaintiff that clearly distinguishes a government agency can't ask questions over email. I've not seen that. I haven't seen that these specific questions are out of bounds.
Well, let me play devil's advocate. She asked those questions after the 45-day period expired, did she not?
She did.
Is that a problem?
It's not.
Why not?
Especially for EADS, because she's not the one that denied the benefits.
Okay.
She knows she's asking questions. But to answer your question, there's a lot going on in between those 45 days and those questions. For instance, there was in Lamley, the mineral interest value between DHS and the plaintiffs was finally agreed on December 20th, 2021, which is within the 45 days. In other words, there's back and forth going on all over the place. This happens to be those five questions that are at issue, that was after the 45 days. But it wasn't radio silence. We weren't sitting on our hands just waiting for something to happen. In Houston, the promissory note was not received. They applied on 1/27/22. They said it attached as exhibit as a promissory, so well, it wasn't attached. So we didn't get the promissory note until March 30th, 2022. So the point is, we weren't sitting on our hands. Things are happening behind the scenes, but those questions may have been after the 45 days. That doesn't mean nothing was happening. It doesn't mean DHS wasn't preparing the application. And Your Honors, Susan Eads is entitled to absolute immunity. She's certainly entitled to qualified immunity. She shouldn't have been sued in the first place. It is my wholehearted belief this was retribution against a lawyer they disagree with. She shouldn't have been here. I request respectfully an affirmation.
Thank you. If you would add, yes, that works.
First, I would say that, I'll pick up with Ms. Eads. I'm sorry, I'm at 318. I mean,
now you get 15 minutes.
Yeah.
She's got 13 right there. That's fine with me, but the red button's on. Now I'm at 16. Okay.
All right.
Ms. Eads, I don't take suing any other lawyer lightly. She was warned multiple times. The advantage I have over counsel I was involved in this case all the way through. Let's talk about the two applicants. Ms. Lamley was 78 years old. She filed an application that was 994 pages long. Ms. Houston, 627 pages, and she was 98. In the applications, they were told that these ladies were incapable of caring for themselves. They were in a nursing home. They gave the applicants gave 5 years' worth of tax returns. They gave full financial disclosures. And I get a question, are they in the business of loaning money?
What is the clearly established law that would support your 1983 claim against Ms. Eads?
1396 AA.
No. You're saying the statute itself is your clearly established law?
Well,
no 10th Circuit case? No.
No, I cited cases in my brief regarding her absolute and qualified immunity. She does not have absolute immunity. Only the judiciary does.
Well, I was speaking as it relates to qualified immunity. And if you know, what is your best case that would say that she committed violated clearly established federal law?
I don't remember off the
law.
Top of my head, Your Honor.
Okay, that's fine. Remember. That's fine. I'll go back to your
brief. One of the other questions that was asked, my personal favorite. Now remember, they're trying to determine feasibility of the repayment. So the question is, what did the lender do with the note? What does that have to do if the borrower can repay? Nothing is the answer. Another question is, what did the borrower do with the assets? All these questions are simply a matter of to delay, delay, delay. See, they gain PECA. That's what's happening here. They're weaponizing PECA. The longer they can delay, the longer they can put it off, then they use PECA as an excuse not to pay benefits. We've heard it today, have we not? We've seen it in the briefs. That's what's going on here. That's the real battle. If we can delay, delay, delay. And I will tell you, as handling this case from beginning to end, there was radio silence. The 45 days came and gone. When we filed the application, we followed up. Have you guys got it? Do you need anything else? I mean, I think 1,000 pages would probably cover it. If they would have read the application, they would have known that the borrowers, the assets that were transferred under the note, generated income that was two times the payment under the note.
What would they know that the person who got could pay that?
Could they pay that?
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem, Your Honor. They never asked those questions. The question is, what's the, under Rose, what was the amount of the note? what's the borrower's living expenses, and what's the borrower's income. We were more than happy. We told them those were the under, we decided rows. Those are the questions. We're happy to answer those questions. Council make it sound like we're obstinate. We weren't. We were just trying to get the right questions.
Trying to get what?
The correct questions. Under Rose, those are the correct questions. It's not all these others that have nothing to do with repayment.
And who gets to make the determination whether they have to do with repayment or not?
Well, Rose did, Your Honor. This court did. This court addressed feasibility in Rose v. Brown. That was a 2021 case.
Yes,
it's
I
in
know
the briefs.
The case.
Okay. They talked about repayment feasibility. We're following the direction of the Tenth Circuit. The Tenth Circuit, in signing the POM, says those are the only three factors: the amount of the loan, the income and of the borrower, and the expenses. We begged to answer those questions, but they never would let us.
All right, counsel. Thank you for your arguments. Case is submitted.
Thank you.